So it is July 24th, 2021, from 26 Second Avenue in New York. And we are going to be reading from the Bhagavad Gita, Chapter 2, Text 59. This is a very important verse, for especially, it's true for all spiritual aspirants, but it's a particularly important verse for those who have a personalistic conception of spiritual life. So, I'll go through the verse once, and then if you can, I'll sing it again if you can sing along with me, staying muted the second time. Vishaya vinivartante. If you could all sing together. Vishaya vinivartante. Niraharasya dehina. Niraharasya dehina. Rasavarjam rahopyasa. Rasavarjam rahopyasa. Param drisvani vartate. Param drisvani vartate. So let's go through the meaning, one word at a time. Visayaha. Objects for sense enjoyment. Vinivartante. Our practice to be refrained from. Niraharasya. By negative restrictions. Dehinaha. For the embodied. Rasa varjam. Giving up the taste. Rasaha. Sense of enjoyment. Api. Although there is. Asya. His. Param. Far superior things. Dristva. By experiencing. Nivartate. He ceases from. Srila Prabhupada's translation. Though the embodied soul may be restricted from sense enjoyment, the taste for sense objects remains. But ceasing such engagements by experiencing a higher taste, he is fixed in consciousness. Srila Prabhupada's purport. Unless one is transcendentally situated, it is not possible to cease from sense enjoyment. The process of restriction from sense enjoyment by rules and regulations is something like restricting a diseased person from certain types of eatables. The patient, however, neither likes such restrictions nor loses his taste for eatables. Similarly, sense restriction by some spiritual process like Ashtanga Yoga in the matter of yam, niyama, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, etc. is recommended for less intelligent persons who have no better knowledge. But one who has tasted the beauty of the Supreme Lord Krishna in the course of his advancement in Krishna consciousness no longer has a taste for dead material things. Therefore, restrictions are there for the less intelligent neophytes in the spiritual advancement of life, but such restrictions are only good until one actually has a taste for Krishna consciousness. When one is actually Krishna conscious, he automatically loses his taste for pale things. Vishaya vinivartante nirahar ashyadehinaha rasavarjam rasopyasa param drisva nivartate. Though the embodied soul may be restricted from sense enjoyment, the taste for sense objects remains. But ceasing such engagements by experiencing a higher taste, he is fixed in consciousness. So we have some very interesting words here in this verse. We have twice the word rasa and param dristva. Dristva here to experience also literally means to see. So something that one is directly perceiving, directly experiencing. Para means other, or beyond, or superior. And again, we have this word twice, rasa. Rasa varyam, giving up a rasa. Rasa apyasa param, giving up a rasa because you have a better rasa. So this word rasa is very interesting. It's a word that's used in Ayurveda. It literally means the juice. The juice, the taste. The enjoyment we get from something is the rasa. And great sages in the Vedic history, like Bharat Muni, have defined rasa as having five components. So all enjoyment has five components. The most important one is what we call the sthaibhav. Sthaibhav means my basic relationship with whatever it is that I am enjoying. Sthai means to stay. It's very much related to the English word stay or stable. So let's say I am trying to enjoy some object. I'm trying to enjoy my computer, my car, a piece of pizza, or something like that. So the basic relationship is what we would call neutral. It's a neutral relationship. My chair is not reciprocating with me. So that's a sthaibhav. Another sthaibhav would be a mood of service. Let's say that I'm really inspired by someone. I really want to help them. So my main sthaibhav is a mood of service. If I want to get happiness from helping someone, or if I want to get happiness from friendship, my sthaibhav is that feeling that we call friendship. Or I may want to help someone in a parental type of way, as a teacher, as a parent, as an uncle, as an aunt, in some way where I'm being the benefactor. So that's also a sthaibhav. And then another sthaibhav is romantic relationships, sexual relationships. So these are our basic sthaibhavs. There are also sthaibhavs like wonder or joy and comedy, compassion, things like that. Those can also be sthaibhavs, the basic relationship. Then there's what we call the bhivav. That's what stimulates our relationship. So let's say that I'm getting happiness from a friend, from my friendship with someone. So my friendship is the sthaibhav, the basic relationship. And as far as what stimulates that relationship, well, my friend, she is going to be my main shelter of that relationship. In Sanskrit, that's called the alambana. And if there's other people who are also mutual friends, those people will also bring out that relationship as what's called in Sanskrit the ashraya. And there may be other stimulants, maybe the way my friend laughs, the jokes that she tells, the places she likes to go to, her taste in fashion, her taste in food. That may all be things that bring out my feeling of friendship. Fun things we do together, fun places we go together. And then there's the anubhav. Anubhav is how I behave in that friendship. What do I do? You know, I take her out to buy her some new shoes, or, you know, we go for a walk together through the forest or something. I do things. Then there's a sattvikabhav. That's how I manifest my friendship involuntarily. I smile, I laugh, I cry. And then there's the vyabhicharibhavs. Those are the various emotions that I feel with the friendship, right? That I may feel sometimes sadness along with my friend, or there may be something scary we do together, or, you know, something like that. So the various emotions, and all of those five together, my basic relationship, the sthaibhav, what stimulates my relationship, the vibhav, how I demonstrate that relationship, the anubhav, how I involuntarily demonstrate it, the sattvikabhav, and all the different emotions I feel, the vyabhicharibhavs. And this is the basis of rasa. All those together make rasa. My basic relationship being the sthaibhav, and then the stimulants, my voluntary actions, my involuntary actions, and my emotions, all joining together with my basic relationship, create what is called rasa. And that can even be true with, like Prabhupada is saying, pale things and dead material things with whom I have a neutral relationship. So like I'm using a computer. So I happen to really like this computer. It's a really nice computer. So that my basic relationship with my computer is one of neutrality, right? And then what is the stimulant? What stimulates my liking my computer is when it works well, like right now, when I'm able to use it for my Zoom call with all of you. So that's a stimulant. Then the actions I do are, you know, I'm pressing the keyboard, and there's involuntary actions. I may smile when things work nicely, right? And then there's the various emotions I feel. So there's the various satisfactions that I feel when things work right. So this all combines again to be rasa. Now, if we want to take up spiritual life, we need to let go of trying to get rasa materially in order to get rasa spiritually. And this fact is well known. In practically speaking, every system of spirituality and every system of religion, genuine systems, it's well known that one has to let go of trying to enjoy materially in order to enjoy spiritually. Now, of course, this concept is often misunderstood as being simply on the gross platform, that if I want to be a very spiritual person, I can't have a car or something like that. I have to just live in a cave in the Himalayas. So people sometimes understand a letting go of material rasa in that way. And indeed, there's been people, again, in all the traditions of the world from the beginning of time, who did act in that way. People, ascetics, who would live in a monastery or a convent, or they'd live in a Himalayan cave, and they would basically not engage with the world, just barely enough to keep alive. And they would have their engagements just be on the spiritual level. One friend of mine many years ago had me watch a 3-hour movie with her of these monks who take vows of silence. And it was actually a little excruciating to watch people in silence for 3 hours. One day a week they would go out for a couple hours and play outside, and then they would talk to each other. But otherwise, they never talked to each other. They would pray together. They would each eat in their own little room. The food would just be like passed under the door, almost like they were prisoners, you know, and they would work in the kitchen or the different works around the monastery without speaking. Anyway, my friend showed it to me because she found it very attractive. I found it very actually unattractive. there are many, many people who think that letting go of material things means like that. It means literally letting go of all things. But in any case, the concept that I cannot enjoy both materially and spiritually, that if I want the spiritual life, I have to be willing to let go of material things. I have to be willing to let go of sensuality and hedonism and worldliness, however it's referred to in various traditions. So, what does that actually mean? What is it that we actually need to let go of? And how do we do that? And Srila Prabhupada's writing in this purport about letting go through rules and regulations, and he's talking about Ashtanga yoga particularly, but having some kind of regulation. He does say that such regulation may be useful for the beginner, for the neophyte, but it's not ultimately the way that we get rid of worldliness. And the way that we get rid of worldliness is param drisvat nivartite, that we have a rasa which we are experiencing on a higher level. So what is it we really need to get rid of? I mean, it's not just a question of getting, you know, I have to get rid of my car, or I have to, when I first took up bhakti yoga, one of the first things I did was I gave my car back to my father. He had given it to me as a gift, and I gave it back to him. No, I'm taking up spiritual life. I don't need a car. So that's not really what we're supposed to be giving up. What we're supposed to be giving up is the concept that everything and everyone exists for my pleasure. This concept that I am the center, and that everyone and everything is basically an object, as Prabhupada talks about in this purport, dead material things, pale material things, perceiving the world as objects, even perceiving other people and animals and plants as objects that are there for my pleasure. That is what needs to be given up. Just like we say that if you want to be serious about bhakti yoga, one shouldn't be eating meat, fish, and eggs. So eating of meat, fish, and eggs entails thinking of those animals as objects. It's pretty difficult. I would like to say impossible, but let's just say it's impossible. Maybe for somebody it's possible. But basically it's impossible to eat something that I understand as having the same feelings and desires and consciousness as I have. It just, we can't do it. We actually are not wired to be able to use something for our own pleasure, to take pleasure at the expense of something else, if we understand that that something else is like me, that something else has thoughts and feelings and personality and desire. And it becomes abhorrent. And one of my relatives is in the military, he's in the Marines, and when he went for the initial training, so it was just, I'm sure you've all heard about, you know, boot camp in the military, so it's really brutal. And he was talking to one of his supervisors who said, you know, it's not so difficult physically to train a human being to kill another human being because our bodies are very fragile. It's extremely easy to kill another human being on the external level. But what we're training you to do is we're breaking the psychological barrier to killing. And that's why it's so brutal, to break down the psychology. Woo! So my point is that as soon as we're seeing, and you find in war, right, generally people do not refer to the people that they are trying to maim and kill as humans. They just refer to them as the enemy, right, or they'll give them a name. Some funny name, you know, the chooks and the kooks, and they'll put some name on them, some non-human sounding name. Now this is what went on, of course, in Nazi Germany, where the people who were being sent to the concentration camps, they were being considered to be less than human in terms of the words that were being put on them. So when we have a materialistic mentality, we see the world as exploitable. And we don't hesitate to cause others grief for our enjoyment. Now, this is a very strong statement that I'm making, but it is actually the fact. And as one progresses in spiritual life, one sees that this is the fact. As one goes on in spiritual life, one starts to see, wow, that's what materialism is all about. I mean, how is it that we've polluted our own planet? I mean, that's kind of madness, isn't it? I mean, I know some people live like that, where, you know, they live in total filth. But, you know, to make our own home polluted, why would we do that? And practically speaking, you know, the civilizations of the world generally have become great, so-called great, by exploitation. Whether it's out-and-out slavery, or whether it's, you know, paying people substandard wages and making them work in difficult situations, or not giving them proper health care, or all over the world, we can see that the so-called great civilizations have come into being on the back of exploiting somebody, you know, whatever, whoever it may be. And you know, I don't think there's very many exceptions to this. And we're all kind of aware of this, that the life we lead in the United States, for example, that it's it's possible because we're exploiting people, both in this country and abroad, in order to get the things that we like and we enjoy. I mean, it's just... But how can we do that unless we have a consciousness that I'm entitled to get happiness at the expense of others, and they're just objects for my enjoyment? Otherwise, how can we do it? How are we capable of doing it? So that's what needs to be given up. Now, many people will say, well, I'm happy to give that up. I don't want to be like that. I'm not that kind of a person. But such is not actually the case. The real fact is that we are willing to do that. We're more than willing to do that. In fact, in many cases, we're very happy to do that, to exploit others, to use others, and to get our happiness at the expense of others. As I say, practically all of us are aware of this. You know, that when we go buy some piece of clothing, you know, for only $5, that we're aware of that fact, that there were all these people involved in that $5 piece of clothing who only got a few cents for their labor, and we're totally fine with that. We're like, yeah, I got this as a good deal. That's the mentality. Now, of course, when we give up a mentality of being exploitive, when we give up a materialistic mentality, then we're also going to live more simply on the earth. That is definitely also a fact. And so giving up an exploitive mentality will, to some extent, most of the time, be symptomized in having a simpler life, because we'll really just take what we need. Yes. However, in the beginning of spiritual life, we don't even understand that we're exploited. We can't really accept that. It's a little bit too much for our ego to bear. And we're not going to be able to give it up because by nature, we are pleasure-seeking beings. Ananda maya byasat. Ananda means happiness. So we are wired as spiritual beings to seek happiness. We need rasa. We need taste. We need some juice in our life. And if we are giving up the taste that we get from being exploitive, then we'll be left with nothing. And we're not willing to do this. You know, even if intellectually we say, okay, I don't want to be materialistic, I don't want to be exploitive, I want to be a spiritual person, we're not willing to live without pleasure. So what can be done? Now, in many, many systems of spirituality and religion, this problem is dealt with rules. Okay, we're going to make rules about what you can enjoy and how you can enjoy it and when you can enjoy it. We're going to restrict your senses. We're going to restrict your mind with rules. But Srila Prabhupada makes the point here in his commentary, in his purport, that restriction from rules doesn't really solve the problem. And I'm sure we've all had the experience that we're restricted from something we like from a rule, but it doesn't change our feeling about the thing we're restricted from. Like Prabhupada talks here about, you know, if somebody's sick, they may be told you can't eat certain things. But that doesn't mean they don't want to eat those things. They don't like being restricted. They're just waiting for the time that they feel better that they can eat them again. I mean, I remember when I was 4 and I had chicken pox, I had a very mild case, but my mother told me I had to rest in bed, but I didn't feel sick. And so as soon as she would leave the room, I would jump out of bed and play with my toys. And if I'd hear her coming, I'd jump back into bed again because I didn't like the restriction. Right? Again, we've all had this experience. We've been restricted from something. You know, you can't watch your TV show until you finish your homework. And so we pretend to finish our homework. We tell our parents, I'm all done, when we're not really. Or we sneak and watch TV where they're not looking. You know, we have some way of trying to enjoy anyway. You know, we see many, many, many systems of religions and spirituality that have really heavy, strict rules to try to keep people from worldliness. You know, I've been in the Muslim countries where, you know, the women all look like they're walking trash bags, so that the men aren't going to be become lusty by looking at the women. I mean, it was really funny. One time I was sitting in the car outside a fabric store with my friend in Bahrain, and these women walked by, you know, the full burqas, and there was some man there, and he was still looking them up and down. And I'm thinking, where is there to look up and down? You know, they're wearing tents. I mean, like, it's all in your imagination. So, they have these super, super strict rules like that. Well, you have, you know, among the Orthodox Jews, even husband and wife, when they're having their intimate relations, they have to keep the lights off, so the man won't become disturbed even by seeing his wife naked. You know, when they have, among the Orthodox Jews, they have special phones that are certified by their rabbis, so they can only access certain pre-ordained internet sites, so your mind won't get distracted. Right? We have, I know in there's many Christian groups and many Islamic groups that don't allow dancing. Right? No dancing of any kind. And there's, at least in the Middle Ages, there were a number of Christian religions that didn't allow any musical instruments. So even in worship, you can only use the human voice. There's many different religions that have very strict guidance about what people can wear. You know, what parts of the body have to be covered, and so many strictures about what people can eat, and when they can eat it, and in what way they can eat it. And these rules can be extremely complicated. You know, they can be very, very complicated, and people will often wrangle and argue about these rules. And I've seen this in our own Hare Krishna movement as well, because we also have restrictions. We say no eating meat, fish, or eggs, no intoxication, no illicit sex, no gambling. We also have restrictions, certain days of fasting and certain days where you can only eat certain sorts of foods. And there are people who will go on endlessly about what specific rule should be followed in what specific way. Can you cook this thing in this way? And can you cook this thing in this way? And will this spice, if you use it with this kind of vegetable and this time of the day and this time of the day? And people get very, very immersed in trying to make sure they are specifically following all of these rules very precisely. Even like we have among Gaudiya Vaishnavas, among Vaishnavas in general, we have 2 days a month where we fast from certain foods, and then the next day you're supposed to eat regular food again. And there's a certain time when the fast starts and a certain time when it ends. And people will be very, you know, they'll be looking, well, I have to stop exactly at this time. And, you know, it's, and people get really, really hung up on following all of these rules to the letter exactly, you know. And many times they'll find, okay, well, here's one authority who says to follow the rules like this, and another authority who says to follow the rules like this. And I frequently get questions from people all over the world about particular rules and how to follow particular rules. So it's useful to have rules and regulations and prohibitions to try to curb down worldliness and exploitation. That's useful. Just like even non-religious, non-spirituality, even a government, you know, the governments of the world, they have rules. Don't murder, don't steal, don't rape, they have rules like that. Right? They have laws and they have punishments. Because they know if they didn't have that, if they just said, okay, everybody, just act according to your heart, you know, well, my heart says to steal your wallet, you know, so that's not going to be very effective. But we all also know that trying to control materialism and worldliness and an exploitative mentality by rules ultimately doesn't work. You know, as many religions and spiritual organizations that have strictures and rules are the same number that have scandals. You know, there's a I read one story about this Christian minister who had a secret porn habit in those days with magazines that he was hiding from his wife. And one time when his wife went on a trip with her friends, he decided that he was finally going to give up his bad habits. So he took all of his pornographic magazines and he threw them into a huge dumpster. And then an hour later, he started thinking, what did I do? What did I do? I won't have my porn. So he decided to climb into the dumpster and retrieve his magazines. And as he did that, he broke his arm and he couldn't get out. And his wife came back from her trip and found her husband at the bottom of the dumpster with a broken arm, surrounded by his pornographic magazines. And this is, you know, everywhere. Everywhere that there's rules, whether it's a government that makes rules, there's scandals of government officials who were corrupt and breaking the rules, and religions and spiritual organizations, and it's everywhere. You know, that someone appears to be a great spiritual leader and that you find out that the person has some private vice that they haven't been able to give up. Because it's just like that, that when we have a restriction, it doesn't take away the desire for the thing. Right? It just doesn't take away the desire for the thing. If you're told, you know, you have some disease and therefore you can't eat this or that, it doesn't mean that you don't want to eat this or that. You know, you may want to be healthy more than you want to eat the thing. But all the doctors know patient compliance is not always very good. And people say, I want to get well, but they don't exercise and they don't give up eating, you know, triple hot fudge ice cream cones or whatever it is that they're restricted by, and they do it anyway. And so this is the reality. And this question is asked by Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita a little later than this verse. He says, why is it that we do things that we know are bad for us and we feel almost as if we're forced to? You know, whether the restriction is imposed upon us by somebody else, you know, our government or our religious leaders, or our parents, or whether the restriction is imposed upon us by ourselves. We might say, okay, I'm going to exercise every day for 2 hours and I'm not going to, you know, watch this on TV, and I'm going to eat this, and I'm not going to eat this. Even if we're the ones who impose those strictures on ourselves, we end up doing things that we know are bad for us. Right? And Arjuna says, why do we do this? Why do we do things that, in one sense, we don't even want to do? I mean, it's a very strange question. Why do we do things that some part of us doesn't want to do? I mean, I find it interesting that the term for such is self-destructive behavior. Isn't that an interesting way to put it? Self-destructive behavior. You know, smoking, drinking alcohol, being promiscuous. You know, these things are self-destructive behavior. They're hurting ourselves. Why would I want to hurt myself? Right? And I would guess that most human beings don't want to be exploitive and selfish. At least ostensibly. If you ask most people, do you want to be an exploitive, selfish person? Most people are going to say no. So why do we do this? It's quite a mystery. It's really quite a mystery. And thinking that we're going to solve this problem with rules, I mean, okay, it's useful to have rules and regulations. It's useful. It's not like it's useless. But it doesn't really solve the problem. Having laws and prisons doesn't solve the problem. It doesn't eradicate crime. Having strictures in religion doesn't eradicate scandals. You know, making a list of what we want to do, and there's so many books and self-help courses about how to have good habits, and you know, why are there so many of them? Because it's so difficult. Why? So Krishna answers this question of Arjuna. He says it's lust, it's kama, it's desire. But what is it a desire for? It's a desire for rasa. It's a desire for rasa. We're anandamaya vyasat. We want pleasure. if we're going to be restricted, so that we don't have any pleasure in life, we will not be able to maintain it. We'll break the walls of the restriction and get pleasure however we can. Because we are pleasure-seeking by nature. We're part of God, we're part of Krishna, and He's full of pleasure. He's ever-expanding, unlimited bliss. And so are we. So the problem isn't so much that we want pleasure. The problem is that we're trying to get rasa in something that inherently doesn't really have any rasa. As we're saying, rasa is like juice. If we're talking about the literal meaning of rasa, it's like juice. Now, I'm sure that we've sometimes purchased some oranges to make orange juice, and they were all like dried up inside. You ever had that experience? You had some oranges to make orange juice and they were all dried up inside. Or you got some avocados that looked really good and you opened them up and they were all like rotten. So that happened to you. You got some avocados, they looked good, they felt really good at the store, and you got home and you opened them up and they were all full of brown spots. Right? It looks like I'm going to be able to make juice from this orange, and I cut it open and it's all just dried out. You know, it's no good. And I couldn't tell from the outside. When I bought it in the shop, it looked like a good orange. It looked like a good avocado. I thought it was going to be good, and I got it home, and it was just rotten. So we're not meant to get rasa exploitively. That's not how we're designed. I mean, that would be awful if that would be how we were designed. And how would that work? If we were designed to enjoy rasa exploitively, then that would mean somebody's going to enjoy rasa by being exploited? I mean, how would that work? I don't like being exploited. So if I'm designed to get rasa by being exploited, then how are those I'm exploiting supposed to get rasa? Everyone is designed to enjoy. Everyone is designed for pleasure. Everyone is designed for rasa. It's who we are, intrinsically who we are. We're full of pleasure. We're pleasure-seeking. Like, I give the example, like a heat-seeking missile. You know, the military has these missiles that they seek heat. They'll go right to the engine of the other plane and blow it up. So we're always looking, how can I get pleasure? And exploitive pleasure, it doesn't even make any logical sense. Because an exploitive pleasure, one person is so-called enjoying at the other's expense. You know, when people are eating meat, the cows aren't enjoying it. Or the chickens, or the pigs, or the goat, they're not getting any pleasure. It's not a mutually satisfying relationship. You know, it's not that the people working in the sweatshops who don't have health insurance and are getting paid, you know, pennies by the hour, they're not getting the same pleasure I'm getting by using my mobile phone. So if pleasure is meant for everyone, if unlimited pleasure is meant for everyone, it can't be in an exploitive way. So actually the exploiters don't even feel pleasure because there isn't real rasa. Real rasa starts with this staibhav. It starts with some relationship. But if the relationship isn't loving, it's not actually a relationship. And the stimulants, the emotions, the actions, both voluntary and involuntary, are all permeated with this exploitation. And therefore, they can't really give pleasure. But I want pleasure. And so, as a living being, if I can't get real pleasure, I'll take fake pleasure, even though it's not satisfying. And that's why we do things that we know are wrong. If we don't have the real pleasure, we'll settle for something that's really awful, but at least it seems to give us something sort of, kind of, maybe for a while. You know, if somebody can't really get a good job and nobody loves them and everyone just thinks they're a loser, they can always get on a video game and there they can win a romantic partner and kill the demons. Now, it's not real. Being a hero in a video game is not, you're not a real hero. But if you're just, you know, a loser in life, then maybe better to be a fake hero than be nothing. So that's kind of like what materialistic enjoyment is. We know it's not satisfying. We know it's actually self-destructive. We know it doesn't meet with our higher ideals, but it's better than being empty. And if the result of following a bunch of rules is that we simply feel empty, that our enjoyment is restricted so much that we feel empty, then people are going to end up breaking those rules. Now again, rules are good, rules are necessary. We couldn't have a civilized society without rules. But they don't solve the problem. And therefore, being very absorbed in the minutia of the rules and exactly how to follow the rules is missing the whole point. The rules of restriction of exploitation are meant to be a very temporary stopgap measure. They're not meant to be the solution. And thinking that they are the solution also means that we think that the process of spirituality is mechanical. We think if I just follow this rule and this rule and this rule and this rule and this rule, then I'm going to get enlightenment or then I'm going to get liberation. I just have to do the right thing. But actually to get enlightenment means a change of consciousness and a change of what we consider to be pleasurable. How we define pleasure. How we find our pleasure. That is the real change required. And what is very sadly ironic is that the pleasure of spiritual life is so great. It's practically speaking indescribable materialistically. And yet, the majority of us really hesitate to let go of our pale, dead, exploitive pleasures in order to experience the real thing. It's like somebody who, you know, doesn't want to let go of their inflatable sex toy in order to have a real relationship. Or somebody who doesn't want to stop eating Twinkies so that they can eat real food. You know, it's actually very sad. Or someone who doesn't want to get off the video game in order to go out and have fun with their friends. You know, the pleasure of actual spiritual life is so much greater on every level because it's real. It's a real relationship between the soul and God. And between the soul and all other souls by the medium of God. It's a relationship of genuine love. It's a relationship based on giving, not on taking. And it's so sweet that one is then satisfied with one's own giving and one's own love. So what's our hesitancy? The hesitancy is because we have to redefine the self. We have to redefine the self. Remember, we were saying that these materialistic exploitative pleasures are also called self-destructive behaviors. Now, I'm going to say something else here really outrageous. In order to be a materialistic exploiter, not only do I have to see other living beings and this world as dead. Actually, everything is divine and conscious. But not only do I have to see everything as dead, I have to hate the very nature of my real self. I mean, how could we engage in self-destructive behavior without having some self-hatred? It's heavy. What do we hate about ourselves? That we're very insignificant. This is a very big universe, beyond anything big that I can possibly imagine. Like some frog in a well trying to understand the Pacific Ocean, you know, trying to understand the universe from my own life perspective. And this planet we're on is a speck in the universe. It's probably only a speck of light to some beings on other planets looking up at the night sky from their planet, looking. Oh, look. That's the third planet from that sun over there. And the, you know, this whole planet is a speck of light to somebody else on another planet. And, you know, on this planet, the city or town in which we live, even if you're in New York, it's a speck. And then it's pretty easy to understand in New York that you're just a speck in the city. That's pretty easy. Just walk down the street at lunchtime on a Wednesday. You know, we're a speck on a speck on a speck on a speck on a speck. Not very many people on this planet really care what we ate for breakfast. Or what we thought about yesterday. Or where we bought our shoes, or what project we finished. I mean, even our family and friends only minimally care. You know, I was recently visiting my youngest son, and he had all these old photographs from my childhood, you know, and he doesn't even know half those people. They're even our family. Right? His children never knew my parents. How many? We're so insignificant. We hate that. We want to be big and important. We want our statue up in the park and our name in the history books. And we want to do something big and significant. And we're so ineffectual. How many of the things that I set out to accomplish can I actually accomplish? How much power do I have? We hate that. But the self is also wonderful and glorious in relationship with Krishna. In relationship with Krishna, the soul is incredibly powerful and incredibly glorious and full of all good qualities. And in terms of love with the Lord, we are all incredibly significant. I remember once, when I was teaching a class, this one woman was holding her month-old baby, and all during the class she was counting this baby's toes over and over and over again. And I remember thinking, I'm sure you already know that she has 10 toes. But to the mother, each toe of her baby was very important. Why? Because it was love. So we're very, very, very significant because we are loved. And we are unlimitedly loved. Even though we are tiny, we're unlimitedly loved, and that unlimited love makes us very significant and very powerful. In other words, we're not significant and powerful in our own right. We're significant and powerful because we're loved. And that kind of grates on the false ego. Wait a minute. I'm significant and powerful and wonderful just because Krishna loves me and I'm important to him. Yeah. Wait a minute. I want to be on my own. So to enjoy this higher rasa, we need to embrace our real identity. I am everything I want to be and more and more and more than I can even imagine because I am loved by Krishna. Not because I, on my own, am anything. An analogy we can give is a spark in a fire. So you watch a fire, you know, a campfire or a fire in the fireplace, and it's beautiful. And every spark of the fire is beautiful, and it jumps up and back in and back and dances. But if a spark of the fire leaves the fire and goes off into the ground next to the fire, it quickly becomes meaningless and extinguished. And it can even just cause trouble, you know, burn a hole in your clothes or something. So when we are in the fire of Krishna, we are dancing sparks and beautiful in that great fire. But if we try to be beautiful and significant and meaningful and relevant and powerful on our own, then we quickly are extinguished or we are simply troublesome. So getting this higher taste, getting this higher rasa, first involves looking at our identity. Who am I? How am I going to know what is my pleasure? What is my food? What is my juice? What is my taste? If I don't know who I am. So this param drishtva nivartate means understanding that I am spiritual. I am eternal. I've never been born. I've never died. I've always existed. I've always existed as a person. I've always existed as a person in relationship to Krishna. I've always existed as a spiritual, glorious, wonderful, powerful, incredible, incredible spiritual person in relation to Krishna. That's who I am. I am Krishna's loving servant. Krishna is my best friend. Surid. Su means wonderful and rid means heart. He is the best friend in my heart. More than any millions and billions of friends that I can have in this worldly life. And when I start to get rasa there, in that way, then gradually I don't need a rule to keep me from trying to enjoy exploitively. That becomes distasteful. Instead of tasty, it becomes distasteful. I naturally turn away from it and say, I don't want that. Why would I want that? Why would I want to see the world as dead and pale? Just so I can think that I'm big and important? If I see the world as alive and divine, full of consciousness, full of joy, full of music and dance, and I'm just one of the voices, I'm just one of the billions and billions and billions of voices. But that is my rightful place. Why would I want to go back to seeing things as dead and pale? And then one gets rasa from one's relationship with Krishna. One has a basic relationship with Krishna. I'm a part of Krishna. I'm a servant of Krishna. What stimulates that is learning about Krishna and his activities and his form and his name and his qualities and his pastimes. The voluntary actions we take are as voluntary service. Involuntary is just laughing and smiling, hair standing on end. We're full of various emotions in Krishna service. And then we experience real rasa that increases and increases and increases. So how do we get from rules, from restricting our exploitive tendency through rules, to the point where we're really enjoying a higher rasa? Well, first of all, we could do it immediately. I mean, that's at least technically possible. On a technical, theoretical platform, it is possible to immediately decide that, yes, I want to totally surrender, I want to totally be who I am, I'm going to give up all exploitive things, and I'm just going to get my pleasure spiritually and immediately give up all material things. That's possible to do that in a moment. That's possible. For most of us, that's not how it works. For most of us, it's a gradual process where we gradually move from being an exploiter and being a materialist and trying to get enjoyment from dead and pale things to getting spiritual enjoyment. So the first thing is that, understanding this, we accept rules and regulations as a temporary crutch. Not being attached to the rules and regulations as if they are what's going to make us enlightened. They are not. No one is going to become enlightened or attain spiritual bliss simply by following rules. Not going to happen. But we accept them as, all right, I need some temporary crutch. I need some rules that I'm going to follow. And to accept that we're probably not always going to follow them perfectly at every moment. Nor should we expect everyone else is going to follow them perfectly at every moment. But to understand that they're there, they're necessary in the beginning. And then to work on actually cultivating this real rasa. All right, how would we cultivate that? Well, first we're going to take the kind of things that we enjoy materially, as long as they're not meat-eating, intoxication, illicit sex, and gambling, and or, you know, criminal activities, whatever, as long as they're not that kind of thing. And we're going to do what Srila Prabhupada called dovetail. So dovetail, if you've ever seen a piece of furniture with dovetails, so it means when you're putting together two pieces of wood, instead of just gluing them end to end, you create like a kind of a triangle, but it's a triangle that has a flat, one corner is flat, and you put the triangles together. And by putting them together, you have a very strong bond. So by putting together two pieces of wood, I don't know if they use it with other things besides wood, but at least putting together two pieces of wood with a dovetail, you make it as if it's one solid piece of wood. It acts as if it's one solid piece of wood. Whereas if you just, you know, put the wood like this, it can easily break apart. So I take the things that I have attachment to enjoying materially, and I say, which of these, again, besides meat eating, intoxication, illicit sex, gambling, you know, and criminal, we're not talking about criminal activities, you know, you can't murder for Krishna or something like that, but other than those things, how can I use this to glorify Krishna? How can I use this to serve Krishna? How can I use this somehow for Krishna? So it's kind of a segue, and our great saintly person, Rupa Goswami, calls this yukta vairagya. So raga means also enjoyment, vai means without enjoyment or renunciation, and yukta means to link. So it's a renunciation that's linked. I'm linking what I like to do with Krishna. And at first I'm going to be doing it still for my pleasure, but externally for Krishna. And gradually I move more and more to internally doing it for Krishna. So just like today I needed to cook my own dinner. Sometimes I eat at my granddaughter's house, but today I was doing my own cooking. So I had a bunch of vegetables in the refrigerator, and I was thinking, what am I going to make? And I decided to make like vegetable pan-fried patty. So, you know, I was going to... So first I took milk, and I curdled it with some lemon juice, and then I cooked the vegetables in that, and then I mashed them up with some flour and a little bit of tapioca flour and some fresh herbs from the garden. I got mint and sage and basil out of the garden, and... you know, a few dried spices and some salt and pepper, and then so I'm going as I'm cooking, right? So part of me is thinking, what do I want to eat? What do I like to eat? Now, if I'm cooking something that I'm going to eat, naturally I want to cook something that I like to eat. It would be pretty silly to cook something that I'm going to eat if I cook something that I don't like. That would be kind of ridiculous. Imagine if you do your own cooking. After you cook it, you sit down to eat it, and you say, but I don't like this stuff. That would be very silly. But I'm also cooking to offer to Krishna. So every time my mind would think about, you know, what do I like, I would think, Krishna, I'm cooking this for you. Krishna, I'm cooking this for you. Krishna, I'm cooking this for you, for your pleasure. So we take the things that we want to do in this world and we say, Krishna, I'd like you to enjoy this. I'd like you to enjoy this. So that's dovetailing. And gradually, as we practice dovetailing, we start really acting for the pleasure of Krishna. We start being a spark that's dancing within the fire instead of a spark that's just, you know, dropping onto the rug. And we find that it's a lot of fun to dance within the fire. That whatever I like, whatever I'm good at, whatever I've been taking my pleasure in, I start doing for the pleasure of Krishna. And we're very fortunate that there's an uncountable number of ways that we can take our desires and dovetail them for Krishna. And in the beginning, our enjoyment is still materialistic, but there's some drops of connection with Krishna, some drops of real yoga. And as we practice more and more and more and more, the percentage keeps changing till we're doing it more and more and more and more and more and more for Krishna's pleasure. And after a while, our pleasure and Krishna's pleasure become one. Just like the spark, its pleasure is part of the fire's pleasure. It's part of the dance of the fire. It's not separate. We don't become one in the sense that we lose our identity. We become one more that, like two people dancing together, become one. Or, you know, the mother breastfeeding her baby, they become one. So that is more that kind of oneness. And as we do that, gradually we start awakening to what is our real identity. And as we start awakening to our real identity, it becomes easier and easier and easier to find our rasa in something that's genuine. And finding our rasa in things that are exploitive become more and more distasteful and bewildering to us. Why would anybody find that to be pleasurable, we start to think. You can feel that in Prabhupada's purport here, where he says, you know, why would you enjoy pale things? Why would you enjoy dead things? The analogy is given in the Srimad Bhagavatam, in the scripture of the Srimad Bhagavatam, that after somebody's chewed sugar cane, you don't want to chew it. There's no juice left in the sugar cane. So most of us, if we're not from tropical climates, maybe that doesn't make any sense to us. But you could think about chewing gum. You know, if somebody's already chewed chewing gum and all the flavor's out, why would you want to chew it? There's nothing left. It's just a jaw exercise. So when one gets pleasure in the spiritual, then naturally, automatically, and it gets to a point where there's no need for rules and regulations at all. There's just no need. Because there's no attraction in being an exploiter. There's just, not only is there no attraction, it's just empty. It's completely empty. It's of no interest. It's just like a piece of cardboard. Like, why would I want to eat a piece of cardboard? So this is the point that we need to come to. You know, following rules of spirituality, okay, that's all right. But we want to come to this point where we're so attracted by Krishna, where he's the stimulus for our relationship, where we naturally want to serve him, where we're naturally filled of all spiritual emotions in relationship to him, that the rasa that we're tasting in relationship to Krishna is so sweet and so satisfying and so all-encompassing, that the concept of being a materialist is, it just doesn't even make any sense to us anymore. It's like, So this is actually the goal. This is actually the goal. And this is when we come to real enlightenment. So we're very fortunate in our Hare Krishna movement that we have so many ways that we can start this process by dovetailing our desires and dovetailing our attachments. There's practically anything that anybody wants to do. Again, not criminal things, but anything anybody wants to do, one can do for Krishna. And one can start to taste this genuine satisfaction, even as a beginner. So we have about 10 minutes or so. If anybody has questions, or I don't know if you can get questions from like YouTube and Facebook. I think at least on Facebook people can ask questions.
Hare Krishna, Mataji.
Hare Krishna.
This is Gail. Thank you so much for the class. There's a couple of things, but I know we have limited time.
Okay.
One thing that she said, that relationship means loving. So what about relationships that are not loving or oppressive, why would we not pull those relationships?
Why would we not what?
Call those relationships. Why does that word automatically mean that it's a loving one? I mean, of course, we all want a loving relationship. We don't want any oppressive or abusive relationships.
No, we can say that there are exploitive relationships and there are oppressive relationships, but exploitive and oppressive relationships are a parody. And the reason that they're not really a relationship is they're not flowing in both directions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I'm abusing you or exploiting you, I'm getting something from you, but what are you getting from me? We're not really relating. Does that make some sense? It looks like that. I mean, we have something to do with each other. So technically, we could say, according to the technical dictionary definition of the word, we're having something to do with each other. But let's say that it's not rasa. There's no rasa there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So if a relationship is not based on some sort of love, there's no rasa. And there's no rasa for the exploiter or the abuser either, by the way. It's not that abusers or exploiters get rasa from abusive or exploitive relationships.
Well, actually, I'm glad you said that because that segues me into my other question, which is why an exploitative relationship necessarily means that this is like a form of self-hatred for a person who doesn't have that higher taste in a relationship with Krishna. Let's say we're talking about somebody who's completely oblivious to, you know, anything spiritual, right?
Yes.
So how is his, I mean, he will even, I think, honestly feel that he gets pleasure in his relationships in this world.
Well, it looks like that. I mean, it's like a person playing a video game can say, I'm getting something out of it, but what you're getting out of it is an illusion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not really getting anything. I mean, if you watch some movie of somebody, you know, beating up all the bad guys and getting the beautiful romantic partner, you're the same person at the end of the movie. What did you get out of it? I mean, actually.
Well, the pleasure, I mean, even though the pleasure might have been momentary, but it was still something, otherwise he wouldn't.
It's something. I mean, sometimes we say it's like a drop of water in a desert.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's something, but it's not real in that it doesn't touch the self. You know, it's like if the guy in the movie wins $1 million, your bank account doesn't have that $1 million in it. You know, the guy in the movie gets the beautiful woman, you don't go home to a beautiful woman in your apartment. So, you know, you may feel while you're watching the movie, you may feel by association with the main character that now you're a great hero who can win beautiful women and knock out bad guys and save the planet or the universe or whatever. But it's not actually happening to you. So all exploitive relationships are not really happening to the soul. The soul is just witnessing it. And therefore, it's not actually pleasure.
So then therefore, is that the reason why you would call our exploitative relationships as a form of self-hatred?
Yes.
Because it's a drop of water in the desert?
It's against the real nature of the self. It's actually going against my real nature.
Mm-hmm.
My real nature is spiritual. And my real nature is loving. That is my real nature. I mean, another example I give sometimes is, I remember one time I was fasting and I took a little nap, and in my dream, I dreamt that I was eating a big banquet. And I was also fasting from water. I was doing an all-day fast from food and water. And in my dream, I was drinking cup after cup after cup of water. And at one point in my dream, I actually took a gallon jug of water and started to drink out of this gallon jug. And then in my dream, I thought, something's funny here. I'm drinking so much water, but I'm still thirsty. And then I woke up and I realized it was dream water. So, you know, that's our... The scriptures compare our life here like that. That we're imagining this. It's not really the soul that's doing these things. So, you know, okay, there's some semblance of happiness, but it's not actual happiness. It's just not. It's not touching the soul.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the way we're designed to get happy. You know, another analogy you could have is of a cancer cell. You know, the cells in the body are meant to be happy by serving the whole body. When my body is healthy, my skin cells are healthy, my heart cells are happy, my brain cells are happy, right? All the cells in my body are happy. And if each cell works for the good of the whole body, then the body also facilitates the happiness of every little cell. But if a cell says, well, I want to get my happiness independently, it becomes cancerous. And then the cell, of course, you know, the cancer ends up killing the very body that nourishes it. So that's not actual happiness for the cell. It's not how it really becomes happy. So it's hating who it is. You know, like stomach cancer, the cells don't look like stomach cells anymore. They look different. They're acting against who they are. I don't want to be a stomach cell. I want to be my own thing. So it's self-hatred. Is that okay?
Yes, thank you so much.
Anybody else? Those are very deep questions. Thank you. Anybody else?
Hare Krishna, Rama Mataji. Maybe you can slightly elaborate how, like, those activities like playing video games or watching movies, how they are also exploitation. Because it seems from the first glance, it's like, oh, it doesn't bother anyone else, so it's...
Well, it's interesting. You know, if you think about what these actors have to do in order to entertain you. You know, the compromising and often dangerous situations that they have to put themselves in to entertain you. I mean, you know, and even you can say, well, the big stars are making millions of dollars, but many of them have really messed up lives. And many of these big stars, they may be very rich, but they have difficulty just, you know, getting along with people and having a decent family or whatever. You know, we're pretty much messing up their lives for our own pleasure. I remember many, many years ago, I was sitting in a doctor's office and I was reading about football players and that practically every professional football player ends up with some sort of lifetime injury. And they were quoting this one football player that said, I realized I was like a prostitute, that I was ruining my own body for someone else's pleasure. Also, the way that even objects are meant to be used, all objects are part of the universal body of God. Everything is divine. Everything is meant to be used for divine service. Well, thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you for talking to me.
Irmala, we have a hand raised by Tashani.
Oh, okay.
Would you like to take that question?
Sure, Atmani Vedanam.
Hare Krishna. Tashani, you want to ask?
Hi, so I am not Hare Krishna. My father was topically, I guess. Most of my life I've had many of the principles still on my heart. And kind of, I don't want to say like, it saddened me that I haven't kind of really come back and learned more. So my question is going to be very, from someone who doesn't know much. So it may sound silly. Forgive me if it does.
No. It's not silly.
Okay. So I wanted to ask, the concept of like serving Krishna or like things being in service of Krishna, why does that exist, like a serving thing? And also, like, why is it that we were ever separated from him?
Okay, so the word service is a really difficult word. You know, I've yet to meet a family that wanted their children to become servants. I haven't met that family. I haven't met, you know, mother and father who say, you know, I hope you grow up and be a servant. Everybody wants their children to become like a doctor or a lawyer, engineer, you know, find the cure for cancer or something like that. And we've replaced in the modern day most of our servants with machines. That basically, because people don't want to do laundry and clean floors, and I mean, you still find in third world countries where there's a lot of human servants, but in most of the developed world, that's gone. And this concept of being a servant is something that's very unpalatable to most people. You know, because we see it as something menial, we see it as something we see it as something exploitive, although it's not always the case. I mean, I know of many families who have servants where the servant is practically part of the family, and it's not an exploitive thing. But we generally think of it like that. We think of it that, you know, the servant is just existing for the benefit of the master, and the master is enjoying 1,000 times more than the servant. Because that's usually the way it is in this world. You know, the servant has a big fancy meal in the fancy dining room, and the servant eats afterwards, and the servant's quarters just whatever's left over. But Krishna's not like that with his servants. It's very interesting that the different forms of liberation for Krishna's servant is to have a form just like God, to live on the same planet as God, to have the same opulences and the same power as God. So Krishna doesn't have any envy. And he treats his servants equally to himself. And Krishna becomes the servant of his servants. Krishna serves the devotees. In fact, Krishna is serving us constantly. Krishna is serving even our material desires. He's giving us a body to fulfill our desires. He's giving us air and water and food. He's serving us constantly. I mean, every religion talks about God as the Father. And the Father is mostly serving the children. I mean, you know, even adult children tend to see their parents as serving them rather than the other way around. You know, even adult children will think, what inheritance am I going to get from my parents? And so God is serving us. And if I give everything in service to Krishna and he gives everything in service to me, then he has a lot more to give than I do.
Right.
You know, I really get the good end of the deal there. So we say service not in the mood of, you know, being a butler or being laundry lady, or that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about giving and enjoying giving. So in all of our relationships that are pleasing, we enjoy giving. You know, I like buying presents for people I love. I like cooking for people that I love. I like helping people that I love. I like doing things for people that I love. I get pleasure from that. I get pleasure from the act of giving. I mean, I enjoy that. And that's what we're talking about. That we take our happiness in pleasing Krishna. And also keep in mind that Krishna is called the super soul or the super self. He's the self of the self. if I'm serving Krishna, ultimately I'm serving the self of myself. I'm not serving someone who's intrinsically different from me or separated from me. I'm really, as Prabhupada would say, serving my own best interest. The question of how we become separated from Krishna is the question. I mean, of all of the doubts and all of the questions, that is the question. How in the world did I become separated? Did I become illusioned in the first place? And you're probably not going to be satisfied with my answer, because I don't believe that intellectually there is a very satisfying answer to that question. Nor do I believe that we can understand that question until we're at a certain, the answer to that question, until we're at a certain level of realization. And the reason is because understanding the answer to that question requires a deep level of humility. It's kind of like asking, you know, why do people smoke? I mean, we're born, most of us anyway, are born with healthy lungs. The majority of people are born with healthy lungs. Why would somebody willingly pollute their lungs? And they have to pay for it too. So why would someone willingly pay money to pollute their lungs and cause themselves disease? Now, I've never smoked, but I don't think the pleasure of smoking is that great. You know, whatever effects nicotine has on the system, I don't know. But is it really that nice that it's worth damaging your whole health for? I mean, is there anyone who smokes because they sit down with some, you know, chart of pros and cons and logically decide that it's a good decision? You know, I don't think so. No. I don't think so. In the tobacco industry, they never advertise like that. You know, the tobacco industry, they don't say, well, okay, smoking gives you this much percentage of chance of lung cancer and heart disease, and you're going to look old before your time. But look at what you're going to get out of it. It's so worth the risk. They never do that. They're selling a fantasy. They're selling an idea that if you smoke, you're going to be some cowboy riding off into the sunset on your horse, or, you know, you're going to have a woman under each arm. I mean, they're selling an idea. So if you say, why does anyone start smoking? You can't really answer that. Mm-hmm. The only reason is absolute, utter stupidity. And the only reason we're separated from Krishna is absolute, utter stupidity. And it's knowing. It's knowing foolishness. It's an aware foolishness. Though that's kind of inconceivable. Why would anybody with knowledge do something that foolish? There isn't a why. There really isn't. I mean, if you want to get into a why, you can say it's curiosity. You could say it's envy. I mean, there's ways you can answer that, but none of those are intellectually satisfying. But at a certain point, one sees it. At a certain point, one understands that actually we're never separated from Krishna, but that out of sheer foolishness, that we had that desire. And it's not simply a desire we had way back in some uncountable history. It's a decision we're making at every moment. We are making at every moment a decision. Do I want to be separated from Krishna? Do I want to have this illusion of separation, or do I want to engage in a loving relationship of giving and service? So we really have that choice at every moment. But people will argue philosophically forever and ever about the original cause of illusion. The question is asked in the Bhagavatam, you know, what is the cause of the living beings being illusioned? And the answer is, you will not like this, it's like seeing your head cut off in a dream. That's the answer. And that's it. That's the only answer that's given. So, of course, if you're seeing your head being cut off in a dream, that's not real. So we're not really separated from Krishna. We have willingly embraced this illusion for no good reason. There simply isn't a good reason. There's foolish reasons. And it's very difficult for us to embrace the fact that we may made or are making such a foolish decision. Something else that may be helpful is that it's not that we've come to this state on this earth planet immediately from our original state of divine consciousness. There's many, many planets and there's many different forms of life, and our first sense of separation from Krishna is very small. It's very slight. And the way I could give you an analogy of this is an alcoholic. So I think I can safely say that nobody plans to be an alcoholic. That when people first drink, they figure they're not going to become alcoholics. It's something that creeps up on them very gradually. Mm-hmm. So our being completely overwhelmed by illusion is not something that happened in a moment. It's something that has crept up on us gradually. And it's not that we made some decision to be separated from Krishna and here we are on this earth planet in 2021, you know, really overcome by illusion. But it's been a gradual thing over many lifetimes and even over many planets.
Thank you so much.
I hope that is helpful to you. And I really have to end because I have gone over time. So
thank you so much. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Avani Vedanam, for this opportunity and for this program that you're doing. Most appreciated.
All right. If people and friends and devotees, if you'd like to join me expressing appreciation for the poignant and enlivening and fascinating class by Irma Machi, and for selflessly and kindly giving us her association. This is a great time, and you can just unmute yourself if you want to. So here goes. Irma Machi ki! Really appreciate it. Hare Krishna.
Hare Bol.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so...